Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today's show is going to be a couple of shows that I've done in the past. And they're not just shows that I'm throwing in to fill up space or fill up time. Actually, I looked at what was going on in the world today, and I thought the best thing I can do in this time is to do some shows that concentrate up some of the key questions facing us out there in the world today. So I decided to do a show on the global warming and the murder of the planet, and on torture, specifically medical complicity with U.S. torture. And I wanted to do this because of the way that these issues have assumed even greater public presence in the world today, with what went on around the climate down in Peru and with the recent revelations brought out in the U.S. Senate report on the CIA and torture. So, at the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Mann. Michael's a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And he's talking with us about the synthesis report released in late 2014 by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show, and I don't think he even remembers that he was on the show a number of years ago, but to welcome back to the show, Dr. Stephen Miles. Dr. Stephen Miles is the author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics. And he's also a practicing physician who has been widely published on the topic of medical ethics and the ethics of torture. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, I have to tell you, you know, this subject, it never ceases to amaze me how deep and troubling this subject is. And, you know, especially when I was thinking about it, I was thinking about a lot of the things that I had read in preparation for this, including things that you've written. There's been a constant, there's always a reference to, and it seems like sort of logical, there's been a there's been a long history of the involvement of medical personnel or people involved in some form of medicine in torture across the centuries. But since the middle of the last century, there's also been a fairly developed and clear set of documents setting out moral and legal standards against medical involvement in torture. So how extensive is the problem today, and why have these documents been so seemingly so easily brushed aside?
Well, you know, it's one of those glass half full, half empty things. You know, on the one hand, we never had codes before the end of World War II saying that docs shouldn't torture. And since then, we've had developing codes. But the thing that's really interesting is starting in 1975, at the same time we started holding government leaders accountable for torture, like in Greece and Portugal and Chile and so forth, we've had an accelerating rate of holding docs accountable for torture. And currently, since 75, about 80 of them have been punished, three more in the last 3 months. And I think we're seeing finally a major turning point in shifting from impunity to accountability.
Hmm. So, but it's now, as you say that, there is still a question of this, you know, this involvement, and we'll get into it a little bit later. But is it still an extensive problem?
Absolutely. In fact, I can personally document 80 countries where I can prove that docs are participating in torture or have participated in torture since 1975 without any punishment. And in fact, it's easily true that there are more docs today who are assisting torture than are treating torture survivors.
Wow, that's a very heavy statement. You know, and one of the things I was thinking about when you were saying this is that, you know, there is this point that you know, you sent me a little link yesterday to a report that just came out. And as you said, you pointed out that it was a part of the report was on the involvement of British medical personnel in torture. And you said that this actually showed just scores of doctors who had been involved in torture.
Yeah, in the British case, this recent report came out and showed that about 58 docs were not properly handling torture prisoners in Iraq. Of course, Britain has a long history of torture that goes back, you know, they had an extensive history of medically supervised torture in the colonies like Kenya, for example, and also in Cyprus. And then there was also torture involved in the war in Northern Ireland. And so this is a continuation. Now, on the positive side, Great Britain just removed for life the license of a doc who supervised torture in Afghanistan, and they suspended the license of another British doc. So we're seeing a shift there, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned, you've said that the involvement of medical personnel in torture today is that it's not just an involvement, it's not just sort of a sideline thing, or it's not just a something that's sort of an, oh yeah, this is happening too. But you've said that the involvement of medical personnel is actually essential for torture today. Can you explain
that?
Yeah,
the docs actually are, they're totally built into the system in several ways. First off, they supervise prisoners to make sure that the ones who aren't supposed to die don't die, okay? And so in that sense, they will run the torture, help the prison system run the torture up and down in intensity so that the prisoner doesn't die. The second thing that they do is they devise methods of torture that don't leave scars that can be used as evidence against the government that administers the torture. Waterboarding is a good example. Psychological torture, how to adjust psychological torture. The third thing they do is they falsify either medical records or death certificates to conceal the fact that torture has occurred. The fourth thing they do is that when they get torture prisoners, they don't report the fact that the torture has occurred. And they do have options for doing this. If they can't do it through their own government, which many times they can't, they could inform local human rights organizations. The docs are passive, and they don't do it, and they're not at risk in many cases. For example, the U.S. docs were never at risk had they chosen to report torture in the war on terror, but they just chose not to report it. So silence is one, direct design of torture is another, concealing torture is another.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Now, when you say that, when you talk about the docs, are we talking about military personnel who happen to be doctors, or are we talking about doctors in general?
Well, actually, some of these are military docs, some of these are police docs, some of them are prison docs, some of them are on contract. That is, the police will have a contract with the local hospital. For example, in Guyana, they had a contract with the local hospital to supply a doc. He came out, saw a kid who had essentially lighter fluid poured on his genitals and lit up, and then the doc came out, put some antibiotic paste on the kid and walked away without making a medical record or reporting it. And then some of these docs are like private docs, and the army will go too far. They'll bring a corpse or they'll bring a badly injured patient to a hospital, and the docs will either treat or they'll turn the person away because they don't want to get involved.
You know, that brings me to this question, which is one that you started with in a lot of the things that you've in your presentations and things that you've written. You said that when you looked at the pictures from Abu Ghraib, that you actually looked and you wondered, okay, where are the medical personnel? And you were wondering where they were at. How did you answer that? And then what happened then? Where did you go from there?
Well, what I expected when I saw the Abu Ghraib pictures, the question was, why didn't the docs blow the whistle on it? And the ACLU was downloading Freedom of Information Act documents. They finally downloaded somewhere, I think, around 130,000 pages of documents. And I went through the medical documents and indexed them. That was about 60,000 pages. Put them up on a gigantic website, which has now been used 1.5 million times. And basically found, to my surprise, that I was looking for how the military had suppressed the docs' protest, and what I instead found was that the military had totally built the doctors into the abuse of prisoners and that they'd gone along with it, which was a surprising finding, and then I wrote all that up, of course.
Well, let me ask you about this. One of the things that I was actually, it's interesting. I know there's been a lot of struggle around this in society generally, and particularly within the profession, and that has to do with psychologists, which actually seems to be, you know, there's the one thing of the sort of the, you know, you have this vision of these, you know, doctors gone mad kind of thing that, you know, that are like medical doctors and other specialties. Then you have psychologists, and there's something that seems very, very, I don't know, it's a really intense area of work in terms of you're fooling around with people's brain, people's behavior. And there's been a particular development where the American Psychological Association is the only medical organization that doesn't have a position against the involvement of their people in these interrogations and what essentially amounts to involvement in torture. Why is that? Why do you think that is?
Well, when the U.S. government, the war on terror, wanted to get into the harsh interrogation business, they wanted a method that didn't leave scars, and so they opted to go with psychological torture. And they didn't want to get the psychologists in trouble for doing this, so they had the American Psychological Association set up a committee to write guidelines, and then they gave something like 70% of the votes to the Defense Department officials who were designing the course of interrogations. And so what the American Psychological Association did then was it wrote a policy that was perfectly dovetailed to what the Defense Department wanted to do. Now, the really bizarre thing here is that the United States, like most Western governments, have studied a course of interrogations essentially since the end of World War II, and has produced a series of studies which show that it doesn't work. You get bad information, not good information. And then, in fact, negotiated rapport building actually gets your best information under all interrogation scenarios. But the psychologists working for the Defense Department decided to ignore all the scientific research and go along with these abusive interrogations. In fact, it got so bad at one point that the FBI, which does interrogations right, they focus on negotiation and rapport building, after protesting to the Army, finally challenged the Army to a duel. And they took a prisoner, and the FBI interviewed this guy and said, look, he doesn't have any intelligence information. He's just a driver. And the guys down at Guantanamo said, you guys are just mollycoddling these people. You just want to give them a hug. We're going to do it our way. And then they went off, and they worked the guy over for a while. And then they came back to the same intelligence briefing, and they said, you're right, he's just a driver. But we're going to keep using our method anyway. And at that point, the FBI pulled out of all of the Army interrogations that were going off the rail.
Boy.
It was bizarre. Yeah. That is my favorite set of emails.
Oh, good. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics. Now, Steve, one question that comes up. In the latest edition of your book, you actually do dig into how interrogation psychologists may have moved from information gathering to coercive experimentation, and you've called this a troubling new direction in U.S. policy and military medicine, as well as an outside-of-the-park violation of the Nuremberg Code on research ethics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, there's this amazing thing that's called the Catani log, and basically it's this weird minute-by-minute log of an interrogation that goes on over weeks and weeks. And it's fascinating that the structure of this log actually matches a older CIA protocol for how one does interrogations. And it appears that what they're doing is they're rotating coercive techniques and then assessing intelligence production as they rotate the interrogation techniques. That is, they'll belittle the person, then they'll see what they say, then they will adjust the fear up and see what they say, and then they'll offer them reassurance and see what they say, and then they'll say, your friends betrayed you, and then they'll see what they say. And it looks exactly like an experiment log. And the abusive research of prisoners was exactly the focus of what we condemned at Nuremberg. And we signed a series of protocols saying you can't do this. This guy actually got seriously medically ill during his interrogation. He suffered hypothermia, which required hospitalization. It was a nightmare hospitalization. And interestingly enough, even though he was seen by at least a dozen medical professionals, and even though the interrogation was designed by a psychologist, it was a naval official who blew the whistle on it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Let me ask you this, and we're coming up on our next to the last question, ethical and moral questions. You know, and it seems to me that there's a huge question here. And some people that are involved in some of the medical personnel that are involved in participating in interrogation and torture will always cite that there's a bigger need, there's a greater good that's being served. The ticking time bomb is the least of the things, but then it goes on from that in that direction. But it seems that there's also a much bigger impact in society at large. There's something that really, an impact on the entire society and each and every one of us in it who allow this, who tolerate this going on. Can you talk about that ethical and moral question?
Sure. First off, the ticking time bomb, I'm just going to say flat out, has been proven wrong. It's an incorrect assumption. It's been tested. It doesn't work. With regard to the larger effect, in order to have torture in your prisons, you have to essentially create a torturing society. That is, what you have to do to create a torture society is you have to define some group as radically other, okay? Jews, homosexuals, blacks, Al-Qaeda, you pick it. And then what you do is you move them outside of the normal framework of law. And then you build special institutions to hold them. And then you suspend the normal forms of legal accountability in those institutions. And then torture happens. And in order to build that kind of institution, you have to have the cooperation of the legislature and the press. You have to have dramas like the TV show 24 to carry the ticking time bomb hypothesis, and we all have to become participants in it. But the problem is that once you do that, you create a society that can be used against its own members, like the guy like Corporal Manning, or which constructs a surveillance against its own members, like the Snowden leaks have shown us. And so the problem is that torture leads itself to the kind of state which endangers all of our liberties.
All right, Stephen Miles, one last question. I know it's not one that you can answer easily, but one question I wanted to ask you. Opposition from medical personnel, opposition from doctors. And I mentioned earlier in the show about this study that came out in last fall, Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror, seemed to attract a lot of doctors who were standing up and saying, we're not going to be part of this. What does it look like in terms of opposition building?
I'm a hopeful guy. We're seeing more and more boards taking this on. I just got a call this morning from another country where they want to take on a doc who did virginity exams against Arab Spring uprisings. We're seeing a movement that is increasing steadily.
All right, Stephen. Thank you very much, man. Really appreciate it. And look forward to talking to you again soon, man. All right?
Please do.
Okay, take care now.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have just been talking with Dr. Stephen Miles. And Stephen is a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a member of its Center for Bioethics. He's also the author of Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors, and he is an expert on the question of medical complicity with torturers. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. And when we come back, we'll be listening to a conversation I had with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, back in September of this year. So stay tuned, you don't want to miss this. We'll be right back. Welcome back. That was Global Warming from Sonny Rollins. All right, and now we're going to move right into the rebroadcast of the discussion I had with Professor Michael Mann. The latest report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was basically secretly leaked to a number of news organizations. And what it says that runaway growth in the emission of greenhouse gases is swamping all political efforts to deal with the problem, raising the risk of severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts over the coming decades. Here to talk with us about this is Professor Michael Mann. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, Michael.
When we last spoke back in April, we talked about another climate report that had just been issued by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that one itself was pretty alarming. And I understand that this draft report is a synthesis report combining a number of separate previous reports on different aspects of the crisis. Well, what's the difference between these reports in terms of content?
Yeah, so some of it is just sort of technical. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is an organization that operates under the auspices of the UN, but literally represents hundreds of the leading climate scientists around the world who get together and put together these extremely rigorous and comprehensive reports every 5 to 6 years, summarizing the state of our scientific understanding of the problem of climate change. And so this is the latest round, the fifth assessment report. And so the way they proceed, they start out with what's called the Working Group 1 report, which is just the basic science. It's the fundamental physical science of climate. What have we learned over the past few years from climate models, from new observations that we compare to the models? What do the models project for the future, given different potential policy pathways that still are in our hands? Depending on what fossil fuel emissions scenarios we pursue, the models can tell us what are the likely changes that result from that. So that's the Working Group 1 report. Then the Working Group 2 report comes out a few months later. It describes projected impacts. If the climate changes in some particular way, what is the impact likely to be on food, on water, on human health, on national security, on our economy, et cetera? And then the final installment of the report, of the three-part report, the Working Group 3 report, is on so-called mitigation, solving climate change. What can we do about this problem technologically, economically? What are the feasible solutions that are available to us to try to mitigate potentially dangerous and irreversible climate change? That's really what the IPCC has been tasked to do back since 1990, when the United Nations Framework Convention first tasked the IPCC to assess, to not prescribe the solutions, but to assess prospects for dangerous human interference with the climate. And so the IPCC has been doing this now for more than 2 decades. The synthesis report is basically just taking all that information from the three different working group reports and summarizing collectively what it all says and what it all means when it comes to contending with the problem of human-caused climate change. And as you noted, the language in this latest synthesis report is quite stark. It's pretty remarkable because this is a very conservative document. The IPCC documents, by nature, are conservative documents. They are consensus documents where the final wording has to be agreed upon by hundreds of scientists with differing viewpoints. It's sort of a lowest common denominator in a sense because of that. It often, to some extent, understates the true potential threats because there's a range of viewpoints, and often the IPCC sort of ends up taking a somewhat centrist line between scientists who tell us that climate change is proceeding even faster than we might have guessed, and critics, contrarians, skeptics who deny that climate change even exists. And so there's still a few of those folks within the scientific community. They have some involvement in the IPCC process. And so that necessarily sort of ends up watering things down a little bit. So if anything, the IPCC is a conservative body. Scientists tend to be conservative. They don't like to stick their necks out, with questionable hypotheses, untested hypotheses, dubious conclusions. Scientists, by their nature, are conservative. And so what's so remarkable in this latest synthesis report is that a conservative body like the IPCC would use the sort of stark language that you were quoting earlier about the fact that we are now contending already with dangerous and potentially irreversible, on human timescales, on timescales that matter to civilization, irreversible changes in our climate that will be increasingly detrimental if we continue with business as usual, which is ongoing reliance on fossil fuels for energy.
Now, tell me this. I was thinking about this study that was done on the state of the oceans a little while ago, and it was really interesting because one of the things they said in doing that is that there had been all these scientists working on separate aspects of what's happening to the ocean.
Right.
And when they all came together, it just blew their minds because it was sort of so evident that basically the situation was much worse than the sum of its of its parts, that the whole was much worse than the sum of its parts. So that's similar to what you're talking about here, right?
Absolutely. You know, scientists, increasingly, we sort of carve off some little niche, some little set of problems that we work on because science has become a huge enterprise. There are thousands of scientists. There's so many things that we are investigating that to really be at the forefront of modern scientific research, unlike back in the 1600s and the 1700s when you had scientists like Joseph Fourier and Sir Rayleigh and, you know, these sort of citizen scientists who might, you know, end up solving four or five of the biggest problems in science of that century alone. That's not the way it works anymore. Scientists tend to be working on small parts of problems, making incremental progress towards our understanding of the way the world works. That's the nature of sort of the modern scientific discipline. And because of that, the sort of situation you described can easily arise. In the lack of sort of multidisciplinary approaches to looking at problems, when you take a problem like the oceans and you break it up so that, you know, you've got marine biologists maybe studying certain aspects of ocean ecology, fish population decline, but you may have geochemists who are studying the impact of ocean acidification. The CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere isn't just warming the planet and changing the climate, it's also acidifying the ocean, which is a major problem. You know, it's already a threat to coral reefs, literally. They will begin to dissolve. They will not be able to maintain their coral structure as the ocean becomes more acidic. And then you talk to people who study the effect of pollutants on animal life in the ocean. And so what happens is you've got all these different sort of communities of scientists studying different problems. And as you say, you bring them all together, and it may be the first recollection on their part that, hey, we're looking at a bigger problem than we realized, because this isn't just a system that is being stressed by one factor. And we all understand this in the way we live our lives. You know, if one bad thing happens to you over the course of the day, you'll deal with it. A couple bad things, well, it's a bad day. But if everything in your life is going wrong simultaneously, it's devastating. It's the whole is much worse than the sum of the parts. And that's true with living organisms. If they are subject to multiple stresses at the same time, they have far less adaptive capacity than if they're dealing with just a limited number of stresses. So when you hit coral reefs with warmer ocean water, which is causing coral bleaching, you hit them with higher CO2 levels leading to ocean acidification, you hit them with pollutants, effluent that runs off into the coastal regions of the oceans and adversely impacts coral communities. Even ozone depletion has been shown to already have had a negative impact on coral reefs. And so they're being hit by all of these simultaneous insults at once. And it's far more difficult to be resilient. It's far more difficult to adapt to sort of an onslaught of negative impacts. And so we're seeing that. We're seeing that with coral reefs. We're seeing that with Arctic ecosystems. With ecosystems where they're being stressed by climate change, but they're also being stressed by development, overhunting, overfishing, all of these things coming together in sort of a perfect storm that represents a far greater challenge for our environment, for ecosystems, for human civilization. The same thing is true with us. We are dealing with so many simultaneous problems right now. Climate change is just one of them. We're dealing with pollution issues, water pollution. We are dealing with loss of habitat, of biosphere. We are, you know, in essence, like the coral reefs, dealing with simultaneous insults to our environment. And that makes the problem far more of a challenge than if we were just dealing with one thing.
All right, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Michael Mann. Michael is the Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the new report, synthesis report, from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, Michael, one of the things I wanted to ask you as well, there's, you know, this report indicates that there's a series of irreversible ecological and economic catastrophes if something isn't done quick. And I wanted to talk about what some of these things are, these you know, these symptoms of all this, or what's actually happening. What are these marks, these scars on the planet right now, and see if we can just get a deeper understanding of this. So in 2009, countries across the globe set a goal of limiting global warming to about 2 degrees Fahrenheit above current levels. What does this report indicate about how that's going, and what are the consequences of what's happening?
Yeah, so the number typically cited is actually 2 degrees Celsius, so closer to 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, relative to pre-industrial time, but these numbers are somewhat subjective anyways. Even 2 degrees Fahrenheit may very well put us in the danger zone when it comes to impacts on food and water and human health. I mean, we're already seeing significant negative impacts of climate change, especially being felt in regions. People who live in the Arctic are sort of seeing climate change ahead of schedule because of the faster warming taking place there. Island nations, low-lying island nations, Pacific Islanders already dealing with flooding because of global sea level rise. So we're already seeing dangerous climate change. But as we go down this fossil fuel highway, we become subject to potentially more and more dangerous impacts. And you allude to sort of these potential tipping points that we may cross, where, you know, we warm the planet enough that we set in motion some changes that we can't undo. That's the irreversibility that we were talking about. The climate doesn't always behave as smoothly as we might like, which is to say you can warm the climate enough that instead of seeing just a gradual response, you'll trigger something. That warming will trigger something very sudden and potentially irreversible. And one of the examples that we're dealing with right now is the issue of the potential loss of ice from the major ice sheets, from the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet. We think that there is enough ice that is vulnerable to melting and to calving into the ocean from those two continental ice sheets to potentially give us, you know, as much as 10 meters of sea level rise. 30 feet of sea level rise, not out of the question. And we'd be talking about, of course, flooding of the major coastal cities of the world, island nations, large parts of coastal U.S., Europe. We don't know how long that will take. That's one of the uncertainties is, you know, how long will it take for these large pieces of the ice sheets to collapse and ultimately yield that global sea level rise? And the fact is, there's uncertainty. But the uncertainty in this case isn't necessarily our friend, because we are learning that, to some extent, things are actually proceeding faster than our models told us they should. And that is true if you look at how much melt is occurring during the summer over the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. We saw just a couple of summers ago something we had never seen before. There was melt occurring over the entire continent of Greenland, everywhere in Greenland, even the northern and most high elevation regions of the Greenland ice sheet, there was melt taking place at the surface. We didn't expect to see that for decades. There have been a spate of recent studies in the leading journals showing that the West Antarctic ice sheet may be far more vulnerable already than we realized, because it is literally being melted from beneath by the warming ocean. And that warming from beneath is actually destabilizing the ice sheet. It's melting the locations of the ice sheet that were in contact with the bedrock that sort of keep the ice on the land and prevent it from calving into the oceans. Those points of contact now appear to be getting eroded by the warming oceans from underneath. And so we may be already seeing far faster rates of melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet and the associated contribution of that to global sea level rise. And I could go on and on. There are a number of aspects of the climate system where we may pass a point of no return. And we may have done that already, in the sense that we may have warmed the planet now enough that we cannot stop a large part of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet from eventually collapsing and contributing to sea level rise. It may be too late to stop that, but it may still not be too late to prevent other things. And so the lesson here is that there's no one tipping point. It isn't like we warm the planet 2 degrees C. If we can't prevent a warming of more than 2 degrees C, we just give up. That's not the way it works. If we don't achieve a 2 degrees Celsius stabilization, we still want to achieve 2.5 degrees. And if we miss 2.5, we still want to stabilize below 3 degrees C, because the more we warm the planet, the more we change the climate, the more likely it is that we see more and more of these potentially irreversible and truly catastrophic changes in our climate unfold.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Now, tell me something. I mean, just out of curiosity here, is they're talking about that there could be ice-free summers in the Arctic in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, and it's another example. If you look at the climate models, what the climate models have been telling us in general is that at current rates of warming, ongoing fossil fuel burning, sort of business as usual fossil fuel burning, if we follow that scenario into the future, that we would potentially see ice-free summers in the Arctic at the end of the century. Well, guess what? We're already almost there. So it turns out that the observations show that Arctic sea ice, summer Arctic sea ice, has been declining far faster than the climate models predicted it to. And we're still trying to figure out exactly why that is. What might be missing from the models that is preventing them from capturing, for example, the dramatic loss in 2012, where the Arctic sea ice had dropped to less than 50% of what it was just a couple decades ago. We're already pretty close now to ice-free conditions at the end of the summer in the Arctic. And if you just sort of extrapolate the current trajectory, it really looks like we'll be there, you know, in a matter of a decade or two, ice-free Arctic at the end of the summer, something the models say shouldn't happen for many decades. And it isn't just academic. It isn't just a scientific curiosity, because as goes Arctic sea ice, goes the populations of polar bears that rely on that environment. So this iconic species, the polar bear, is now established as a threatened species by the U.S. government because we are literally destroying its environment. We're melting the sea ice environment that it requires for its hunting. And that's just one example. I mean, if we lose that Arctic sea ice, then we fundamentally lose an entire unique set of ecosystems that rely on that environment, the Arctic ecosystems, polar bears and walruses that rely on that environment, and all the other animals and plants that are part of that system. If we melt the Arctic, we lose a unique ecosystem that won't be replaced.
You know, and that does emphasize this whole point about the interconnectedness of this all. And I wanted to raise something else in relation to this point in particular. Well, not the loss of this unique ecological setup in the Arctic, but something related to the sort of connectedness of all these problems. When we spoke last spring, we talked about what people were postulating then as a possibility, which was that as these ice sheets melt, that there's organic material that has been frozen over for a long time that becomes exposed and begins to rot, and that there's the possibility of the release of really large amounts of methane, and that can have very dire and different consequences in a certain sense to the atmosphere, to the climate. And that apparently just recently they have actually discovered the release of some methane in that Antarctic region.
Yeah, and so what one of the things that, you know, we've known for some time is that there's a large amount of methane that exists in a frozen form, either in the permafrost, the Arctic tundra as permafrost in the ground, or along the coastal shelves of the oceans. And it's stable at certain temperatures and pressures. That methane is stable in sort of a crystalline form. But if you warm the coastal shelves or you warm the permafrost even a little bit, you can potentially destabilize all that methane that was frozen. And methane, as it turns out, is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. On timescales of a couple decades, it's 100 times, almost 100 times as potent as CO2. Over a time frame of a century, it's about 30 times as potent as CO2. So there's been this worry. This is another one of these potential surprises, these potential tipping points, something that can be triggered that we didn't really fully account for, that the models don't really account for. If we warm the climate and we stabilize that methane, then suddenly we get even more warming because we're putting all of this methane greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. It's another of what we call a positive feedback, which sounds like a good thing, but a positive feedback in this sense is a bad thing. It's an amplifying factor. It means we get even more warming than we otherwise would have. So the sort of $24,000 question then is how much of this methane really is sort of close enough to the point of destabilization where it could be released on a massive scale in a short period of time in such a way that it would substantially aggravate the climate change problem, the problem of global warming. And there is a debate within the scientific community. It's important to recognize that there isn't a consensus yet among scientists that this methane feedback problem is a major problem. If you talk to experts in this field, some of them will point to the fact that we are observing methane being released from coastal shelf environments. There was a crater that opened up recently in the Siberian permafrost that we believe was a huge belch of methane being released into the atmosphere as the ground, as the permafrost is warming. But if you do the math, and you calculate how much of it that we're seeing, it's not yet to the point where it's a serious competitor with the warming influence of the CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere with fossil fuel burning. So it's something to keep an eye on, and it could potentially be another one of those aggravating factors that kicks in and makes the problem worse than we had originally envisioned. But at this point, it's potentially a distraction from really the fundamental source of the problem, which is our ongoing burning of fossil fuels and the increase in CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere.
We're talking with Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the latest report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, the report indicates that if nothing is done, then the effects of climate change will be irreversible. And related to that, it says that even if we act now, there's a risk of abrupt and irreversible changes. And it points to, for instance, the idea that carbon released by burning fossil fuels will stay in the atmosphere and the sea for centuries, even
That's
if
right.
we completely stop emitting CO2 as soon as possible. What does that mean? What's the consequences of it?
Yeah. So, I mean, by some measures, we're already seeing potentially irreversible changes. That appears to be true with the melting of the ice sheets. There's quite a bit of evidence that's mounted now that we have already committed to a substantial loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet. We've passed the point of no return. It isn't like we could cool the climate back down, bring CO2 levels back down, and drive that process backward. That's not a possibility. It'll proceed no matter what we do. So we may have passed that tipping point. But there, as I alluded to before, there are other tipping points, the collapse of the North Atlantic Ocean circulation. There are all sorts of these potential abrupt changes in climate that could take place, but we don't think we've yet approached the point where those tipping points are a threat. But certain tipping points we've already potentially crossed. And so by that measure, we have already ventured into the realm of irreversible climate change. Now, as you say, the other irreversible aspect of this is just the CO2 that we're putting in the atmosphere. It takes the oceans and ultimately the sediments at the bottom of the ocean, which slowly absorb carbon. It takes these processes thousands of years to play out. So if you put a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere very suddenly, it's going to take the Earth system thousands of years to remove that CO2 from the atmosphere. What that means is that we have already committed to an elevation of CO2 concentrations well above pre-industrial levels for more than 1,000 years. And if you talk to some of my colleagues, like James Hansen, the former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, one of the leading climate scientists in the U.S., Hansen has argued that probably even 350 parts per million CO2, which is where we were several decades ago, even that is too high. If we allowed CO2 to persist even at the level that existed during the late 20th century, that would lock in potentially dangerous climate changes. So we're already too high. Forget about trying to avoid 2 degrees C warming. We've already warmed the climate enough to put in play, to allow to unfold some of these more potentially catastrophic changes in our climate. There are scientists who believe that to be the case. And if that's true, if we are already above the sort of safe limit of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the CO2 we put into the atmosphere will take centuries, if not millennia, to come back out of the atmosphere through natural processes, then the implication is that not only do we have to stop fossil fuel burning and other human activities that are elevating CO2 in the atmosphere, we actually have to be implementing technological schemes, if you will, to actually draw CO2 down from the atmosphere, to literally suck the CO2 back out of the atmosphere. And that's an expensive endeavor. It's feasible technologically, but it's expensive to do, and yet it may be necessary if the expense of not doing that, if the consequences of allowing CO2 levels to prevail at current levels, if that indeed has potentially catastrophic implications, we may have to turn to these technologies, carbon capture and sequestration technology, to literally pull some of the CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere back out of the atmosphere.
We're talking with Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And we're talking about the latest report from the UN Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. I have two more questions. One is the droughts, and particularly in California, there's a big question of the drought and the way it's impacting people. But I've also read things like across the Southwest and in New Mexico, they're talking about intense desertification actually beginning to spread. What about this? They said this could all result in a mega drought that's worse than anything in the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, and I saw that article, and whether or not one frames it in terms of mega drought or not, I'm not sure that's the most helpful framing. Frankly, I think a more relevant question is just the average drought conditions in the desert Southwest, the west coast of the U.S. Is climate change making that worse? That's a more basic question.
Yeah.
And the answer seems to be overwhelmingly yes. The California drought, this record drought, not just a record, but it broke previous records by a very large sort of amount. I mean, it's by far the worst drought conditions that California has ever seen. They essentially had to create a new color on the drought map that they use to communicate the deep severity of this current California drought. And we know that climate change contributed to that. We know that climate change is leading to warmer conditions. I mean, California also had near record heat, if not record heat, this summer, in at least large parts of California. So you've got this heat, you've got earlier and earlier melting, you've got less accumulation of snow in the winter, earlier snow melt from the mountains, you've got decreasing precipitation in many cases. So it's all sort of coming together, again, in this sort of perfect storm to give us unprecedented levels of drought in California, but also more broadly in the desert southwest of the U.S. And this is something that the climate models have predicted for some time. So what we're seeing happen, the desertification of the desert southwest, is something that the models have predicted, but we're actually learning that it may be worse than we thought. Another example of a surprise, some new aspect of the science that we didn't understand before that's coming into play and is potentially making this problem worse. There have been a number of studies now that suggest that this really odd jet stream pattern we had last winter, where it was extremely dry, relatively warm on the west coast, and then we had the jet stream sort of crash down into the central U.S. and the east coast, giving us unusually cold conditions over a large part of the winter. So we had this huge contrast between the west and the east in the shape of the jet stream. The jet stream was basically going north into Alaska rather than traveling through California and Oregon, which normally get all that rainfall in the winter. That was a lot of that was going north into Alaska. And so the rainfall and the snow at higher elevations. So that pattern, that particular pattern of the jet stream that led to those conditions, there are some studies now that suggest that climate change may indeed be favoring that pattern of the jet stream. So the climate models already said that drought was going to get worse in California and the desert Southwest without taking that factor into account. Now with this additional factor, which we saw play out in real time last winter, with the possibility that climate change is having some role in that as well, the problem may be worse. Another example of, yes, there's uncertainty, but look, in many cases, as in this case, uncertainty may be playing out in such a way that the effects are worse or more devastating than we thought they would be. And that may very well be true when it comes to California's ability to meet its water needs. Obviously, this latest drought has been a major threat to water security in California, and that may be, you know, a sign of things to come. It may become the new normal. And if that's the new normal, then places like California have to fundamentally rethink how they are going to find the water resources they need.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Now, one last question. No matter what, it seems large-scale climate shifts are inevitable in one form or another, and their impact is going to be, I mean, a lot of it is known, a lot of it is sort of soon to be or discovered in a certain sense. But you've talked about, and you've mentioned this a number of times, that there are contrarians out there. There are people who are these anti, you know, global warming, anti-climate change, all this other stuff, saying it just doesn't exist. And you've sort of done a remarkably good job in terms of just saying, look, dismissing these people more or less, just like, look, you can't pay attention to a bunch of clowns out here that are doing whatever. But you've spoken about how scientists are actually the real skeptics, and that lends even greater strength to the report, that the science behind this report and the dire situations facing humanity in relation to global warming, real and accurate. While it's the scientists are skeptics in terms of how they carry this stuff out, how they develop all this, this stuff, they are not agnostic, and that this is actually true.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And there are individuals and groups, many of them associated with fossil fuel interests or, you know, the Koch brothers who fund a lot of these front groups that exist to try to poison the discussion of climate change, that exist to try to promote misinformation, disinformation, denial of the basic science of climate change. A lot of that is manufactured. It's well organized. It's funded by special interests like the Koch brothers through organizations like, you know, so-called Americans for Prosperity, et cetera. And in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, I talk about my experiences at the center of the attacks from those organizations, those institutions who worked hard to try to discredit this iconic graph that I published a decade and a half ago, the so-called hockey stick curve. It became sort of an icon in the climate change debate because it very clearly demonstrated the unprecedented nature of recent warming. And because of that, it became an object of attack for those looking to discredit the science. I became an object of attack myself, and I tell my story in the book. But one of the things I also talk about in the book is the issue of scientific skepticism. In fact, I have a chapter called A Candle in the Dark, and it's an homage to Carl Sagan's wonderful book, The Demon-Haunted World, A Candle in the Dark, where Sagan talks about true scientific skepticism, and he distinguishes it sharply from pseudo-skepticism, from contrarianism, from denial. You know, people who reject the overwhelming scientific consensus about climate change aren't being skeptical. If you look at their arguments, the basis of their rejection of the mainstream science is the flimsiest of arguments that don't stand up to even the slightest bit of scientific scrutiny. Now, that's not skepticism. That's the opposite of skepticism. But they'll often try to wear the mantle of skepticism. They'll try to present themselves as modern-day Galileos when, in fact, I think it's Sagan in his book says something to the effect that, yes, you know, they did laugh at Galileo, but they also laughed at Bozo the Clown. And you know what? You guys aren't Galileo. So you have that. And I think a lot of that is becoming increasingly marginalized, as it should, in the discussion. And climate change deniers aren't quite getting the voice that they once did. Some media organizations are, you know, doing a better job in not falling prey to sort of the fallacy of false balance, where, you know, if you're going to talk about the latest developments in planetary science, you don't invite somebody from NASA and somebody from the Flat Earth Society and have a debate. You know, that's not the way it works. And it shouldn't work that way in climate science either, because the scientific community has reached a very strong consensus. The problem's real. It's caused by us. There's a worthy debate to be had about what to do about this problem. That's what we should be discussing. And interestingly enough, just earlier today, there was a report that China has now agreed to a cap-and-trade scheme. So now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases in terms of aggregate emissions, they're lower than the U.S. in terms of per capita emissions, but the world's largest emitter, China, has now committed to cutting its greenhouse gas emissions through a cap-and-trade scheme. It really means that other countries like us have no excuse. We can't point to China and say, well, they're not doing anything about this problem. So let's have that discussion. But as far as the science is concerned, the scientists, as you say, true scientists who are skeptical recognize that there are things that are understood and relatively well settled, and that includes the fact that we're warming the planet and changing the climate, and that it is a problem if we don't do something about it. And there are other things that are still uncertain, and we're still trying to work out. We're still trying to understand, for example, how precisely climate change is going to impact phenomena like hurricanes and tornadoes. We still don't know the answer to that problem. We don't know yet exactly how climate change is going to influence the El Nino phenomenon. And that's really important because El Nino, as you know, living on the West Coast, has a profound influence from year to year on rainfall on the West Coast. It has a profound influence on regional weather patterns around the world. And so if we want to be able to make projections of changing weather patterns that stakeholders can take into account as they build adaptation strategies, we need to be able to better answer some of those questions. And so there's a broad area of research questions in climate science where scientists like myself and my many colleagues are still working actively to figure these things out. What drives science, what's interesting to us scientists, isn't what's already known. It's the anomalies. It's the things that don't fit and understanding them. In fact, I have a section in my book, It's the Anomalies, Stupid, because that's really what drives scientific curiosity, is not showing the other guy was right, showing, yeah, everybody got this right. It's figuring out the thing that nobody else has yet been able to figure out. And that's driven intrinsically by skepticism and critical sort of assessments of scientific developments. So true scientists, true good scientists are real skeptics. But the people who often try to pass themselves off as skeptics in the world of climate change denial are no such thing at all. They're the opposite of skeptics. They're contrarians. They're deniers. They are purveyors of pseudoscience.
And on that note, Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Just a fascinating discussion, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Always happy to come back.
All right. We've been talking with Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And Michael was speaking about the synthesis report released in late 2014 by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank both of my guests today, Dr. Stephen Miles and Michael Mann. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with just a little bit more from Sonny Rollins and Global Warming. Bye.